like to present the Honorable Brett G. London. He is a judge on the Orange County Superior Court. He was first elected as a judge to the West Orange County Municipal Court back in 1988. And he was most recently re-elected to the Superior Court in 2012. Judge London's career and character-building experiences span from being a gardener to a taxi driver to a Superior Court judge. He received his Bachelor of Arts degree in English from Cal State Fullerton and his Juris Doctor cum laude from Brigham Young University. Brett and his wife Donna live in Lake Forest and are the proud parents of six adult children. So we'll turn the time over to Honorable Judge London and let him present his topic.
Well, Benjamin Franklin is a remarkable and most fascinating person. In short, he was an exceptional writer and printer and created over 1,000 famous quotes and proverbs that we use today. He was a brilliant scientist, and he did groundbreaking experiments in electricity and oceanography. He was an exceptional inventor, invented the lightning rod, the bifocal glasses, the flexible urinary catheter, and the famous Ben Franklin wood-burning stove. He was an outstanding model citizen. He founded the first public library, the first volunteer fire department, the first public hospital, the first liberal arts academy, and the first think tank in the colonies. He was an outstanding leader and diplomat. He spent 25 years abroad in England and France representing the colonies. We'll talk about how he rescued the American Revolution. And he was the only founding father to be involved with both the Declaration of Independence, the Treaty of Paris, and the Constitution. So he participated in the drafting and signing of all those, and the only founding father. What an incredible individual. I was trying to think of how to describe him, then I came across a term, Googling it, that Franklin is recognized as a universal genius. A universal genius is defined as a super genius who is exceptionally brilliant in many fields of academics. Now, universal geniuses are extremely rare throughout human history. There are only 28 recognized universal geniuses. Only two Americans qualify for that. And interestingly, both are founding fathers. Ben Franklin, who grew up in poverty and only had 2 years of education, and Thomas Jefferson, who had the best education money could buy. To have two universal geniuses alive at the same time, in the same place, in an undeveloped British colony in the 1970s or 1700s, defies the odds. Well, let's talk about Ben Franklin. He was born in 1706 in a small wooden house in Boston. He was the 15th of 17 children. His father ran a meager candles business out of the house. Ben Franklin always had a thirst for knowledge. Using only the King James Bible, he taught himself how to read by the age of 5. He went into school at the age of 8. After 2 years, his father pulled him out of school. The mother, realizing Franklin's gifts, begged the father to leave him in school. His father said he doesn't need any more education to be able to make candles and pulled him out of school. But Ben had an unquenchable thirst for knowledge. So as a child, he satisfied that in three ways. First, he pestered all of his father's clients and customers by asking them about their careers, their occupations, their skills, and their travels. Secondly, he tried to borrow as many books from his father's customers as he could. And in that way, he taught himself French, German, Italian, Spanish, and Latin. And then third, he observed and analyzed nature. So at the age of 11, he was analyzing how a duck was able to swim so well with the webbed feet. And so he invented wood hand paddles and wood fins. And he challenged his friends to long-distance races on the Charles River, and he won. Now, my first exposure to Ben Franklin was in sixth grade. I was assigned to read one of his biographies and write a report on him. There's only two things I remember from that experience. Number one was that he has the first recorded attempt at using swim fins. And number two, one of his famous quotes, "A penny saved is a penny earned," is really "a penny saved is a penny got." So those two things stuck in my mind since sixth grade. At age 12, he started helping his brother in the printing business, and here he had access to more books, and he would often stay awake most of the night reading to just satisfy his voracious appetite for learning. So he began writing. At the age of 16, he realized that he was a better writer than his printer brother and his brother's authors. So he started writing anonymous satirical articles under pen names, and he used the names Mrs. Silence Do-Good, Alice Addertongue, and Henry Meanwell. And he slipped these articles under his brother's door at the printing shop. His brother was so impressed that he printed all the articles. Well, the articles took the outlandish wrong side of issues. They advocated more puddles. They advocated more crime. They advocated more flies, more trash, more garbage. And these satirical articles sparked public debates on all those issues. Well, a year later, his brother discovered that Ben was the author of those articles. His brother went into a complete rage. And so Ben fled Boston at the age of 17 and went to the big city of Philadelphia. And there he started apprenticing as a printer. So at age 20, he formally came up with his 13 virtues that you have on the handout. We won't go over those. He was always involved in self-improvement and character building. And so those are his 13 virtues. And so as we look at some of his aspects, he was an exceptional writer and printer. So he worked as an apprentice for 5 years in printing. He was very frugal, saved his money. And at the age of 22, he was able to buy his own printing press. He was a master printer. He started his own newspaper, the Pennsylvania Gazette, which became the most popular newspaper in the colony. In 1733, he started publishing his famous Poor Richard's Almanac, and he is credited as the first person to ever print a political cartoon. And in 1775, Franklin was hired to print all the paper money for New Jersey, Delaware, and Pennsylvania. Well, this time, counterfeiting was a huge problem, but counterfeiters were no match for Franklin. So he did two things to prevent counterfeiting. Number one, he would misspell one word on the face of the bills. So when the counterfeiters looked at that, they assumed that those were fake, and they would correct their spelling on their phony bills, which they could identify as counterfeit because all the words were spelled correctly. Secondly, on the back of the bill, he would put floral scenes with leaves on those, and instead of having an artist engrave the leaves, he actually used the leaves somehow in the printing process of the money. And so there was so much intricate detail on the veins of those leaves that no one could counterfeit those. And it wasn't until the 1960s that a historian going through Franklin's papers realized that those were actual leaves, and it was an anti-counterfeiting measure that Franklin had done. And no one knew that until about 20, 30 years ago. Well, Franklin was so successful as a printer, he retired at age 42. He left us over 1,000 quotes and proverbs that are famous. I have that on the second page, some of those. Let me paraphrase a few of these, and you don't realize these came from Ben Franklin. No pain, no gain. God helps those who help themselves. Honesty is the best policy. One of my personal favorites. House guests are like fish. They begin to smell after 3 days. Only two things are inevitable, death and taxes. Early to bed, early to rise makes a man healthy, wealthy, and wise. You catch more flies with honey than vinegar. Never leave till tomorrow what you can do today. Fight fire with fire. You know, all these quotes that we're using all the time came from Ben Franklin. And then one of my favorites is, three people can keep a secret if two of them are dead. So Franklin was a brilliant scientist. When he retired from printing, it gave him more time to devote for his experimentations with electricity, which he called electrical fire. In 1749, he invented the lightning rod, and because of that, he saved thousands of lives and buildings over the years, and to this day, most lightning rods are based on his original design. In 1750, he tried to convince people that he could kill and cook a turkey with electricity. And so he scheduled a public demonstration. He had two giant batteries that he made that would do a spark between the batteries. Took a turkey. He took the turkey, held it up between the batteries. A blinding flash went off. Everyone was blinded. The turkey was flying around, flapping, and everybody looked up, and Ben Franklin was not there. He was unconscious on the floor. When he finally regained consciousness, he complained about chest pains and numbness, which finally went away the following morning. And now he almost proved you could kill and cook a person with electricity. In 1752, he did his famous kite experiment, trying to prove that lightning was electrical fire. And once again, it was a miracle that he survived that experiment. He discovered the polarity of electricity. He came up with the terms positive and negative. He came up with the terms battery, conductor, electrician. And he proved that electricity conducts itself differently with different objects and at different temperatures. And so because of his amazing research in electricity, in 1753, he received the prestigious Copley Medal. That was the highest award from the Royal Society of London and is the equivalent of today's Nobel Prize. And then in 1756, he was inducted into the elite British Royal Society. So he also did breaking forefront research in oceanography. While he traveled back and forth across the Atlantic, he took regular measurements of temperatures, and he proved the existence of and mapped the Gulf Stream. And he came up with theories about ocean currents, ocean cooling, ocean evaporation, and their impact on climate change, which is a current issue today, but he was way on the forefront. Now, Franklin was also an extraordinary inventor. Necessity is the mother of invention. Unfortunately, that's not a Franklin quote, but it really applies to his life. Many of his inventions were personal and never caught on with the public. So one was the swim fins, because the wood fins didn't quite work out well. But for his efforts, in 1968, he was inducted into the International Swimming Hall of Fame for his efforts with respect to the hand paddles and the swim fins and his advocacy of swimming. Another invention, he got tired of reaching up on the shelves for his book, so he invented a prosthetic arm extension. You could hook on your arm and reach the books. That never caught on. Another one of his personal inventions was the library chair. He attached a fan to the chair that you could operate with a foot pedal, so you can keep yourself cool. Another one of his private inventions was the air bath. You know how you air out clothes or stinky things and stuff? Well, he had the theory that you needed air out the human body. It was healthy. So once a day, he would open all his windows, take off all his clothes, and sit naked in front of the window for a half hour. When he got older, he sometimes stood on his second-story balcony overlooking the public square to get an air bath. Today we call this indecent exposure. But as far as we know, no one complained about his air baths, but those never quite caught on either. So those are some of his personal inventions that work for himself. His public inventions, one is the Franklin stove. During his time, as you know, most people cooked and heated over their open fireplace hearth. Most of the smoke went in the house. Most of the heat went out the chimney. And so he invented the wood-burning Franklin stove that would keep most of the heat in and most of the smoke out, and it was easier to bake and cook on. And one of the principal reasons he invented that was because it used less. You didn't need as many candles and wood. So he always was obsessed with candles his whole life because he started off as a candle maker. In 1749, he invented the lightning rod. It was called the Franklin's rod, or the electrical attractor, and a majority of the systems today rely on that. He advocated daylight saving time because with more natural light, you use fewer candles. Another one of his inventions was the glass harmonica, a musical instrument. Most of you have taken a wine glass and rubbed your finger around it and makes a tone. Well, he took several dozen glass discs, put them on a tube, different sizes, hooked them to a mechanical device that you would turn, and as you put your fingers on the tubes, you could make chords and music on the glass discs. And it kind of created this ethereal sound. The invention was an immediate hit. Over 100 composers wrote music for the harmonica, including Mozart and Beethoven. Franklin said, quote, "Of all my inventions, the glass harmonica has given me the greatest personal satisfaction." And during his life, over 5,000 harmonicas were manufactured and produced. But unfortunately, someone started the rumor that glass harmonicas caused insanity. And a German article came out proving that glass harmonicas caused self-mutilation and suicide. And so his popular musical instrument went belly up. Glass harmonicas are occasionally used today. You can look up on the YouTube glass harmonica and hear concerts and performances with this. And you can purchase one today for about $20,000. Now, he also invented the bifocals. He was tired of using two different glasses for a close and distance, so he invented the bifocals. He also invented the flexible urinary catheter. His brother suffered from kidney stones, and they would take a large metal tube once a day into the bladder to evacuate the urine, and this was very painful, so Franklin went to a blacksmith shop and came up with a smaller catheter made out of a silver alloy with holes on the sides so that it was flexible. And so today he's responsible for inventing the flexible urinary catheter. Well, some of these are tremendous inventions, but Franklin refused to patent any of them. He thought that this was knowledge that should be with all the public without any remuneration. And just thinking of patenting the lightning rods, the bifocals, and the wood-burning stove would have made him a fortune. Well, he often is referred to as Dr. Franklin. So the question is, where does that come from? In Franklin's day, an honorary degree was more prestigious than an actual degree. An actual degree just showed you had potential for achievement, whereas an honorary degree was given for significant achievement. And so in 1753, he got an honorary master's degree from Yale. 1753, he got an honorary master's degree from Harvard. 1756, he was awarded an honorary master's degree from William and Mary. 1759, he was awarded an honorary doctorate degree from St. Andrews University in Edinburgh, Scotland. And in 1753, he was awarded a doctorate degree from Oxford University in England. Thereafter, he was referred to as Dr. Franklin, despite the fact he only had 2 years of schooling. Let's talk a little about his family. You recall that at age 17, he ran away from Boston and went to Philadelphia to work as a printer's apprentice. While there, he boarded in the house of a Mrs. Reed. Mrs. Reed had a 15-year-old daughter named Deborah. Ben immediately fell in love with her and proposed marriage. Understandably, Deborah's mother refused, since they were just teenagers, to allow the marriage. Thereafter, Franklin went to England, to London on an assignment. He was delayed. While he was delayed, Deborah married a lowlife. The lowlife stole her dowry, committed several crimes, and fled to Barbados, never to be heard from again. Unfortunately, because of bigamy laws, since his fate was unknown, she was never allowed to legally remarry throughout the rest of her life. In 1730, 7 years after proposing to Deborah, Ben had an illegitimate son named William Franklin by an unknown mother. Shortly thereafter, he and Deborah agreed to establish a common law marriage. That's kind of living together as husband and wife without being married. They had two children. Their son Francis died at age 4 from smallpox. He had a daughter, Sally Franklin, who had 7 children and helped look after him during his old age. So unfortunately for him, Deborah, his common-law wife, was so afraid of the ocean, she refused to go to Europe with him. So he spent all those years in England and France without her. She died in 1774 of a stroke when he was on his mission to England, second mission, and he returned in 1 year later in 1775. So he was a widower for 26 years. His illegitimate son, William, they sent him to London to study law at Temple Inn. Like father, like son, he had an illegitimate son. And he named his son William Temple Franklin and put him in foster care. In 1764, when Franklin went back to England on his second mission, he stayed there for 11 years. While he was there, he looked up young William Temple, who was about 4 years old at that time. Ben's heart went out to him, and Ben took custody of him and raised him as his own son. Now, his son William became the governor of New Jersey, and when the American Revolution broke out, his son remained loyal to the British. Franklin never forgave his son. All attempts of reconciliation were rejected, and at the end of the war, William was a wanted man and had to flee to England. And Ben Franklin opposed any efforts to grant him clemency or to pardon him for his actions. Now, Ben Franklin was an outstanding citizen and model public servant. So as I mentioned, he founded the first public library, the first volunteer fire department, the first public hospital, the first liberal arts academy, which became the University of Pennsylvania. He formed the first think tank, which became the American Philosophical Society, and the first mutual insurance association. He worked hard to try to get the streets paved and the lighting increased to reduce crime and to increase public health. Well, Franklin was a leading statesman and diplomat, so he was called the first American. The reason for that is twofold. One, his tireless advocacy of colonial unity and independence. And number two, that since he was a self-made man, he always advocated hard work, self-reliance, and education. So these became the quintessential American values in Europe, and thus he was referred to and given the title the first American because he exemplified self-made man working up through the system. His first diplomatic mission to England was in 1757. The Pennsylvania Assembly sent him to England to complain about the Penn family and how they were operating in Pennsylvania. His second diplomatic mission started in 1764. The infamous Stamp Act, the citizens were starting to get rebellious. He stayed in London for 11 years. It just convinced him that the intransigence and brutality of the king and parliament convinced him that war was the only option. So he returned on May 5th of 1775. The next day, he was elected as a delegate to the Continental Congress. 1 month later, he was appointed as the first Postmaster General of the United States. So he was placed on a committee of five to draft the Declaration. On that committee was the other universal genius, Thomas Jefferson and John Adams. I would have loved to have heard the discussions between Franklin and Adams and Jefferson. One of their big debates was over the national symbol. So Adams felt that our national symbol should be an eagle, a bird of strength. Jefferson opposed that because he said the eagle is nothing but a sophisticated vulture. It's a predator. The national symbol should be a dove, a bird of peace. And Franklin disagreed and said, no, the national symbol should be an indigenous animal, so it should be the turkey. I'm glad that I couldn't say I was a turkey scout. I'm glad that John Adams won that debate. So in his 70s, he was sent to France after the Declaration was signed to try to convince the French to get involved in the American Revolution. He took his grandson, William Temple Franklin, with him, and his grandson spent his entire life as a diplomat after that. So foreign aid from the French was vital to beat the British Empire, and Franklin adopted a three-pronged policy. First off, he believed that you had to win the hearts and minds of the people, then you had to win over the aristocracy, and then, if you got both of those, you could win over the king. He also believed that the messenger was often more important than the message, and so personal relationships was crucial. So he knew that the French considered the Americans a bunch of frontiersmen, and so in France he started wearing his coonskin cap and a beaver coat. So you had the formal portrait of him in the coonskin cap. He was an international celebrity already, and he spent a lot of time out among the public wearing that ridiculous hat. And so he became so popular that women started fashioning hairstyles based on his coonskin cap. And so he won over the hearts and minds of the public. Well, then he started socializing with the aristocracy, the idle rich with their powdered white faces and powdered wigs. So he would go to their parties, he would teach them American Revolutionary songs, and he would pass around his coonskin cap collecting donations. So he specifically also wined and dined several influential elderly aristocratic widows who we knew had the ear of the king. And so now in his mid-70s, he played the role of party animal and womanizer. And in this way, he won over the aristocracy. So finally, he was granted a personal audience with the king. Franklin insisted on wearing his coonskin cap and his beaver coat. That was unheard of. You dressed up to visit the king. The king relented and allowed Franklin to wear his costume. And so the king was so impressed with Franklin's mastery of the language and culture that the king spent a lengthy time questioning Franklin about science, philosophy, and politics. And after that discussion, he won over the French, and the French supported the Americans with both money and troops. And accordingly, Franklin was given another title at this time. In addition to Dr. Franklin and the first American, he was known as the man who rescued the revolution. So when he left France, there was a huge crowd at the docks saying goodbye to him, and unheard of, King Louis had his personal royal coach pick up Franklin at his residence and take him down to the docks. Franklin got back, was immediately elected governor of Pennsylvania. 2 years later, he was put on the Constitutional Convention. He was quite old at this time. He was 81. He didn't serve on any committees, but his influence was second only to George Washington on that committee. And everyone who had an idea tried to lobby to get Washington and Franklin on their side. Washington was insistent on remaining neutral on everything. But if you could win over Franklin, then you could win the debate. So a couple of issues that may be interesting to you. Franklin and slavery. So most citizens at Franklin's time had slaves. He had a handful of household slaves. White Europeans assumed that black Africans were inherently inferior. Franklin's newspaper, the Pennsylvania Gazette, advertised for the sale of slaves and also printed notice on runaway slaves. However, he also published anti-slavery ads in the same editions, sponsored by the Quaker and other abolitionists. In the 1760s, he finally decided to study the issue of slavery, and he became an abolitionist. Although he had a few household slaves until 1781, in 1763, he wrote that Africans were not inherently inferior to whites, that any shortcomings were caused by ignorance due to lack of education, the collateral damage of slavery and negative environments, and he proclaimed the radical notion that African and white children had the same capacity for learning. So that was a radical notion at that time, but once he studied the issue, he converted himself to be an abolitionist. In 1790, less than 3 months before his death, the sick and feeble Franklin formally petitioned Congress to end slavery. They immediately rejected his petition. So what about Franklin and religion? Franklin publicly declared himself a deist. He considered himself a Christian with a small c. He retained a strong faith in God as the source of morality and goodness. In his autobiography, he stopped attending church as a young adult so he could spend more time studying. So he was constantly studying. He explained, "I have never doubted, for instance, the existence of deity, that he made the world and governed it by his providence, that the most acceptable service of God was the doing good to man, that our souls are immortal, and that all crime will be punished and all virtue rewarded, either here or hereafter." And a month before his death, the president of Yale University asked him what his views on Christianity were. He wrote back and said, "As to Jesus of Nazareth, I think the system of morals and his religion, as he left them to us, the best the world ever saw or is likely to see. But I have some doubts as to his divinity, though it is a question I have never really studied." So notice he really focuses and studies on an issue and forms an opinion, but that one was one he just kind of never got around to or didn't think was that important. "I see no harm, however, in it being believed, if that belief leads to good consequences." So his death and funeral, because of his obesity, middle age and older, he suffered from multiple health problems. The famous one is gout, which is an arthritic, painful condition in the small bones of the feet. His health problems worsened, so after the Constitutional Convention, he was rarely seen in public until his death. And he died in his home in Philadelphia on April 17, 1790. He was 84 years of age. Franklin was probably the most beloved founding father, and his funeral was attended by over 20,000 people. So he was buried in Christ Church Burial Ground in old downtown Pennsylvania. At the age of 22, he wrote his own epitaph. It says, he's very self-sufficient, "The body of B. Franklin, printer, like the cover of an old book, its contents torn out and stripped of its lettering and gilding, lies here, food for worms. But the work shall not be wholly lost, for it will, as he believed, appear once more in a more and perfect edition, corrected and amended by the author." Great, great epitaph. But that wasn't his epitaph. In his final will, he said just Benjamin and Deborah Franklin. So over his grave, they put a large marble slab, and it's next to the public sidewalk. So if you go in Boston, you'll see this monument with thousands of pennies thrown onto the monument as good luck, and in honor of his phrase, "A penny saved is a penny earned." Last year, they realized that after 225 years of people throwing pennies on the stone, that it started to crack, and so they found established a foundation to repair and maintain the stone. Well, Ben Franklin and the other founding fathers firmly believed that this nation was established by divine providence. Without divine providence, it was impossible to defeat the British Empire. In 1787, the Constitutional Convention reached a critical impasse. To break the logjam, Ben Franklin introduced a resolution to begin each session with prayer. Here are his words. "In the beginning of the contest with Great Britain, when we were sensible of danger, we had daily prayer in this room for divine protection. Our prayers were heard, and they were graciously answered. All of us who were engaged in the struggle must have observed frequent instances of divine providence in our favor. And have we now forgotten that powerful hand? Do we now imagine that we no longer need his assistance? I have lived long enough, and the longer I live, the more convincing proofs I see of this truth. God governs the affairs of men. And if a sparrow cannot fall to the ground without his notice, it is probable that an empire cannot raise without his aid. We have been assured in sacred writings that except the Lord build the house, they labor in vain that build it. I firmly believe this. I also believe that without his concurring aid, we shall succeed in this political building no better than the builders of Babel. I therefore beg leave to move that henceforth prayers imploring the assistance of heaven and its blessings on our deliberation be held in this assembly every morning before we proceed to business, and that one or more of the clergy of this city be requested to officiate at that service." Well, the convention adjourned before they addressed Franklin's proposal. However, to this day, the House and Senate in Congress begin their sessions with prayer. So in closing, Thomas Jefferson referred to the Founding Fathers as an assembly of demigods. And for generations, Americans revered and almost worshipped these demigods. We built statues, memorials, universities in their honor. We named cities, counties, and statesmen states after them. These demigods include George Washington, Thomas Jefferson, James Madison, Alexander Hamilton, Thomas Paine, John Jay, John Hancock, John Adams, Patrick Henry, and Benjamin Franklin. What are the odds that such an... I only have a few lines left. What are the odds that such an assembly of brilliant thinkers, courageous leaders, and selfless politicians would gather together at one time and place and establish the first democratic republic built on law, equal opportunity, and the rule of law? The Founding Fathers firmly believed that this nation was established by divine providence. when we look at the founding fathers, these noble men of character, and look at the miracles surrounding this birth of the nation, then we have to agree with them and with Benjamin Franklin, Dr. Franklin, the first American, the man who saved the revolution, that this indeed is indeed one nation under God. Thank you.